Can you hear me all right? Is the sound coming through clearly and audibly? Okay. So glad to hear it. Okay, so as we do, we're going to spend the beginning of our time together tonight doing some insight meditation practice together. And then we're going to take a short break. And then I want to share with you some of the sort of research and reflecting that I've been doing since we last got together, when I was talking about how does one go about skillfully applying the Dharma to serious issues of social action and social justice. And so I want to share the fruits of my research and reflection, but more importantly, I want to also open it up for discussion we can have among ourselves on that very topic. So, of course, what we'd like to start with is doing some meditation practice together. So we'll invite us all to settle in, find our sitting posture, whether we're sitting on cushions on the floor or in a chair, maybe lying down. And of course, you're muted, so if you snore, then no one will know. But we anticipate that we'll all hang in there. When you are sitting in your posture, what we want to begin by doing is allow a sense of settlement and self-focus to begin to sink in. When we're driving a car or walking or almost any kind of mental activity that involves movement or that involves even reading or watching television, what the mind is doing is always anticipating what is next. You know, if you're behind the wheel of the car, it's a really good skill to have, so you can anticipate what traffic conditions are going to be. But what we're going to take a little time doing now is allowing the mind to relax from that process of always being a little bit on the future. We're relaxing the mind to the point where we can begin to come more and more into the present moment. And we do that first by turning our attention toward fully and consciously inhabiting the body. So finding a sitting posture that is balanced and allows you to be at ease and centered and calm, with your arms relaxed at your sides and your hands folded in your lap or on your legs, but also to be awake and alert. So check your posture, make sure that you're sitting upright, your shoulders back and your head up. Okay. And then allowing the eyes to gently close. This evening, we're going to begin by doing our meditation practice, beginning with mindfulness of the body, then all things. And then at some point in our sitting tonight, I am going to recite some verses having to do with sharing the fruits of your Brahma-Vihara practice with all beings. It's a little bit of a blend between the Bodhisattva vow in the Mahayana tradition and the practice of the Brahma-Viharas in the Theravada tradition. And I'll repeat the phrases a few times, so that then, if you wish to, you can make those phrases your predominant focus of attention for the practice, or simply come back to them periodically while you're doing your insight practice. But we'll be focusing on these phrases and where they come from and what they mean during our discussion period this evening. So let's settle in, allow the eyes to gently close, the attention to come to rest on the breathing. wherever you find your attention to the breathing most easily coming to land. Whether it's sensation of the air moving in and out of the nostrils, or perhaps the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the surface of the ocean on a calm day.
May all sentient beings have happiness and the root of happiness. May we be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May we never be separated from the highest bliss, which is without suffering. May we come to rest in limitless equanimity, which is without attachment.
Once the mind has become a little clear and calm through attending to the breathing, allow the field of awareness to open wider. Other aspects of awareness of the body. Awareness of the pressure of your body on your chair or your cushion. That pressure being an expression of the relationship between your center of gravity and that of the earth. Your bond with the earth element. Noting the sensation of moisture in the mouth. Bringing awareness to the water element. The flowing fluids within our body, making up 70% of our body mass, just as the oceans of the world cover 70% of the globe. And the salinity of the oceans and the salinity of the fluids in our bodies are the same. Water element. Feeling the flowing of the air in and out of the nostril or down into the abdomen, back up again. Rhythmic and flowing inward and outward. The movement of air in and around the body. The wind element. Feeling the pulsating of your cardiovascular system in your fingertips, or hearing it in your ears, feeling it in your neck, or perhaps the temperature of your body relative to the air around you. All manifestations of the fire element. Awareness of this body as a body. The earth element, the water element, the wind element, the fire element. Allowing the mind to come to rest on the body, just as the body rests on the cushion. Now allowing the mind to further expand to take in awareness of thoughts or emotions. As they arise and change and pass away, like clouds moving across a great sky. Where there is sadness, may I bring joy. Where there is violence, may I bring peace. And where there is hatred, may I bring love. Where there is cruelty, may I bring caring. Where there is sadness, may I bring joy. Where there is violence, may I bring peace. And where there is hatred, may I bring love. Where there is cruelty, may I bring caring. Where there is sadness, may I bring joy. Where there is violence, may I bring peace. And where there is hatred, may I bring love. Bring caring. Where there is sadness, may I bring joy. Where there is violence, may I bring peace. And where there is hatred, may I bring love. So, Kathleen, thanks once again for doing the IT honors this evening in terms of facilitating. Do we have any announcements of any upcoming Dharma-related activities, either within the Sangha or elsewhere, that anyone would like to share with us tonight? Hearing none, I guess we'll go ahead and talk about mindfulness and compassionate action. So I brought that topic up a couple of weeks ago and saying that for me it was a point of really intense investigation right now, something that I was needing to look harder into, and because I, with all the kind of the turmoil happening in our society right now around a variety of issues, whether it's racial injustice or failed response to a deadly pandemic, radical economic inequality, threats to the well-being of our planet, that it felt like, felt compelled to engage in some kind of action, but not really altogether sure sort of what my grounding was and whether I could do it in a way that was generally reflective of the way I try to live the Dharma. And so I've been doing a lot of pondering on that, a lot of reading on that, from different Dharma traditions. And the two that I know the most about are the Tibetan tradition, the Vajrayana, which is where I actually started out with my investigation of Buddha Dharma, and then, of course, the Theravada. So I've been looking for teachings and for advice on how to skillfully bring the Dharma to bear on the suffering of the world. And in so doing, because I have experience with and draw on both of these traditions, I'm also aware that there is a very vigorous debate going on, or that has been going on ever since the Dharma came to the West. It first came here either through Asian teachers coming to the West and teaching, or through Western students going to Asia and hearing teachings and then coming home and sharing themselves. And the different traditions have different ways of understanding things and different ways of presenting things. In the Mahayana tradition, Zen and both Zen and the Vajrayana, there's a lot of emphasis on the wisdom of the teacher and going for refuge to a particular teacher, kind of surrendering one's ego and one's practice to learn that. The Theravada tradition, not so much. The Buddha in the Pali Canon talked a lot about finding the teacher within, and discovering your own inner wisdom. Another kind of sort of traditional distinction between the two is that in the Mahayana tradition, there is what's called the Bodhisattva path or the Bodhisattva vow. And that's one where, as part of one's practice, one vows not to seek liberation for self alone until all beings have been liberated. In other words, sort of decide not to step off the wheel and not to attain final enlightenment in order to help others. So when Western students began to pick and choose which teaching had the most relevance and importance for them, some Asian teachers got pretty upset. They said, you know, this American pragmatism is really kind of missing the point. You know, you're either going to ride one horse or you're going to ride the other one. Insisting that the teaching had to, you know, that you needed to stay within the confines of a particular tradition if you were going to get anywhere with it. No dilettantism. And to a point, I could really understand that and could hear the truth in it. Because I tried some practices here and some practices there, and then realized at some point, if I really, I came to realize that actually, especially the Tibetan, the Theravada, both of those systems are internally self-referential, right? They have their own language, they have their own ways of understanding what's going on in the mind, what to do about in different things at different times, and what the stages of spiritual maturation consist of. But they're not really the same worldview. There's some kind of considerable divergences. So I looked here and there for a while, and then I really did go in deeper, you know, for within the Theravada tradition for several years. And then at some point felt like there were a few things missing, so I turned to the Tibetan tradition again and did some deeper practice and learned what I think that, radically different way of going about things, you know. But then it was like when I go to a Tibetan retreat and I was the only person there with, you know, Theravada background, you know, there would be this, sometimes it was like people felt sorry for me. I hadn't yet, you know, found a way to attain the higher, more rapid path. And that's kind of a wrap on the Tibetans anyway. They tend to, you know, they call their path the Vajrayana. You know, there's the Theravada, you know, the lesser vehicle, the Mahayana, the greater vehicle, and then the Vajrayana is the royal vehicle, you know. Maybe it comes from living on top of the world and looking down at everybody else. But in that way, you know, the Tibetans, the Vajrayana, they're no different from any other tradition in terms of attachment to views. You know, it happens in all the traditions. You know, there's this tendency to see one's own as superior, you know, because it works for you, because it really resonates, because it helps you understand the world better, understand yourself better, and begin to live a life with greater integrity. But way back in about the 6th century of the Common Era, one of the elders in the Xuan Buddhist tradition in China, who later was seen as a founder of, not only Xuan Buddhism, when that practice went to Japan, it went by the name of Zen. So he's spoken of as the third Zen elder. And what he said way back when is, there is one Dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the needs of the ignorant. And what he was doing was pointing back to the Buddhist teachings about craving and clinging. You know, and the Buddha said the four most difficult things to let go of, you know, he's talking about the second ennobling truth, you know, the truth of craving. He said we crave sense desires, we crave pleasures for the body. We crave the belief that rites and rituals will be enough to bring us liberation rather than the internal work of awakening. We cling to, the Buddha said, views and opinions. And that includes views and opinions about the Dharma. And so, clinging to views, having fixed views, the Buddha said, is a pretty serious form of suffering. Hard to let go of. And then, of course, the final form of clinging is clinging to the notion of a permanent and abiding self. So, based on Seng Stan's observation, there is one Dharma, not many. My friend and teaching mentor, Joseph Goldstein, a few years ago, wrote a book by that name. It's called One Dharma. And the purpose of his book, by that time, there were all these Dharma traditions established here in the West. And everyone was kind of signing up with this or that team, you know, and we're beginning to treat the Buddha Dharma traditions in the West, just in the same sectarian way as Christianity. You know, you can't be a Methodist and Unitarian at the same time. Well, maybe you can't be a Methodist and Episcopalian at the same time. You know, either play for one team or another. There's that kind of mutual exclusivity. And the same thing is true, you know, with regard to the Dharma, but can be. But what Joseph, the point Joseph made in his book, he said, you know, attachment to views really misses the point. Number one, it ignores the Buddha's teaching in the Second Noble Truth. But he said the other thing that happens is that you become unable to take in and live the fullness and the richness of all the Dharma has to offer. So it's coming from an understanding that no one path or tradition is inherently superior or inferior to another. They all have something to offer. They all have ways of teaching what the Buddha is thought to have shared with the world that leads to liberation. And ultimately, in Joseph's view, and it's actually, well, happily, it's also the view of the Buddha. You know, when the Buddha taught what he called the parable of the raft, you know, and he was likening the raft to the Dharma. You know, you fashion a vehicle to help you get across this rough, you know, fast-moving river. Okay. But then he said, once you get to the other side and you're proceeding on your way, you carry your boat on your back. And he said, no, you have no more use for it. It took you where you needed to go. And so he had this very utilitarian attitude toward his own teachings. He said, they are to help you get to a particular place. So there are these two views. One is you got to stay within the confines of one tradition in order to get the goodies. But the other is that once you do become well enough grounded, you know, in one or another of these traditions, okay, that it really is possible to skillfully discern which teachings from which traditions make the most sense for you as a Dharma practitioner. Because the Buddha said over and over again, the Dharma is an ends to a mean and not, you know, to a goal. It's a means to an end. It is a way to achieve the goal. The Dharma, practicing the Dharma, is not the goal itself. It has a use. And it needs to be understood that way. It needs to be held like a Fabergé egg. Kind of this beautiful thing that has much to offer, but not if you grasp it too hard. So, how does all that relate to figuring out how to bring the Dharma to life in the, on the street, especially in times of conflict? From the Mahayana tradition, we have this thing called the Bodhisattva vow. And for those who choose to live the Bodhisattva path, you know, they take the vow, beings are numberless and I vow to save all. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So it's to dream the impossible dream. You're taking the vow to do that which no one human being can do. Okay. And that's kind of the point. You have to let go of the idea that I personally am going to make all these things happen. And instead, you simply devote yourself to those goals, you know, full-heartedly. And then however things unfold, they unfold. So, sometimes that approach has kind of backfired in the West, when yogis have taken the vows so seriously that they would tend to feel badly about themselves when they weren't measuring up. So there's a Zen master with a sort of a dry sense of humor, Koben Shino Roshi. I led the sanghas in coastal California for a while. And he kind of rewrote the Bodhisattva vow. He said, sentient beings are numberless. They will save themselves. Delusions are inexhaustible. They will end by themselves. Dharma gates are boundless. They will open continuously. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to allow it. He's playing a little bit. He's saying, letting go, you know, just let go. You know, we do what we can, but if you get too serious about it and you get too attached to outcome, you know, you're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble. Okay. So what I want to do a little bit right now is explain one particular way that I have been integrating the Mahayana and Theravada traditions that I'm finding to be useful in my quest for how to skillfully bring the Dharma to bear on social action. So I know I've told the story a few times here in the Sangha about the sort of the myths and the legends and the, some of the historical fact around figure of Tara in Vajrayana Buddhism. And the historical roots are that there are many stories about how the Dharma came to Tibet, and there are lots of efforts to bring the teachings there over the centuries from the time of the Buddha's death. Most of them didn't stick too well. You know, the principal legend in the Vajrayana is the bringing of Buddha Dharma to Tibet by Padmasambhava. The story of Tara is one of how Buddhism came to be the Tibetan state religion, how it finally became the way things were done. And it back in, I think, 6th, 7th century Common Era, Tibet was in the process of being unified amongst these various mountain tribes that had been, you know, at each other traditionally by its really fierce and powerful warlord and general named Songtsen Gampo. And he forcibly unified all these mountain tribes as really fierce warriors. And then once he had gotten them kind of stitched together, then he used them as this really powerful instrument for the invasion of both China and India. And so they would come tearing down out of the mountains, and they would rape and pillage and steal stuff from the local villages and make life miserable for everybody, and then turn around and gallop back up into the mountains. And once they got back up into their mountain refuges, they were, there's, you know, no one could get out. You know, those who tried did not come to a good end. And he kept doing this. He got richer and more powerful and richer and more powerful. And he was real, it was real pain. It was really, really disruptive and disturbing for both the Chinese and the Indians living along the border. So one of the traditions at that time was one of the ways you chill out somebody like this guy. And if you're trying to make peace rather than continuously be attacked by them, and what you do is you send a highborn princess to become what was called a hostage wife to the warlord, okay, a hostage bride. And you live sort of as a prisoner in the warlord's court, but having that person there is also a kind of an insurance policy against him attacking her family members, right? So that it was a way to kind of chill the guy out a little bit. both India and China sent hostage brides to Sacsayhuaxpo's court. And the idea was that they would play off each other so that neither China nor India sort of gained the upper hand in terms of relationships with Sacsayhuaxpo. But instead, as the story goes, what both China and India did was to send princesses that were very learned and had very deep practice of the Dharma. And that when they got to Sacsayhuaxpo's court, what they did was conspire together to convert Sacsayhuaxpo to Buddhism. And this they succeeded in doing through manifestations of compassion and selfless joy, equanimity, loving kindness. And he basically came to see that life as it was being lived in the presence of these women was richer and better than anything he'd ever known. And so he made Buddhism the state religion, and he stopped attacking, you know, the two Taras, the White Tara from China, who basically is kind of a Tibetan version of Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva compassion in China, and Green Tara from Bengal, from northeastern India. Had the combined effect of converting a nation that had been drenched in violence into one that was at peace, both with itself and with its neighbors. So, you know, instead of all this, like, you know, war making and raiding and whatnot, what do you say to some peaceful and mutually sustainable and agreeable trade? So that's what happened. So the real gift that the Green Tara and the White Tara brought, you know, in the in this understanding, White Tara is the contemplative form of compassion. Okay, sitting in meditation, cultivating compassion. Okay. Green Tara is referred to as the Bodhisattva of compassionate action. And if you see statues of Green Tara, she has one of her legs extended as if she's getting ready to go down into the world, you know, and share the blessings of the Dharma with others. But what they both do, what they both stand for, is bringing a peaceful heart to violent situations. Okay. And that's one of the reasons that I chose that name for my feminine aspect, because it's aspirational. I want to try to live my life in accordance with what they were trying to do. So one of the things that I've been experimenting with in my own practice, because coming out of the Theravada tradition, I've been mostly, the family of practices in the Theravada tradition of Vipassana or insight, Anapana, mindfulness, breathing in the body, Jhana, deep meditative absorption practice, deep concentration practice, and Metta, practice of loving kindness, you know, the Brahma Viharas. And so what I've been working on is how to combine those two in some way that that is functional and that kind of honors both. So that's where this, you could talk it, you could think of, you know, the practice that we were doing as kind of the Brahma Vihara vow. It is the way the Buddha taught the Brahma Viharas, you know, for him, he basically said they're something that you cultivate within the heart mind, and it simply radiates out in all directions like the sunshine, right? when you put together the intentions underlying the Bodhisattva vow, okay, with the practice of the Brahma Viharas, what becomes possible is taking the energy, this radiating energy, this quality of radiating energy that the Buddha taught generally goes outward in all directions to touch and serve all beings. It's bringing it to bear on a particular situation. So Bhante Gunaratana and his teachings about mindfulness meditation, you know, he said what the practice of Vipassana does is it slows down the mind's rate of activity while it speeds up the rate of attention. He said it's as if there's a spillway at the bottom of a dam and you have this, what looks like a placid lake, you know, up on the top, but down at the spillway where there's millions of tons of pressure on the water at the bottom and a small place where it comes out in a very focused and very forceful way. And he said, that's what becomes possible to do with the mind. So in this conjoining of the Bodhisattva intention, the intention to bring awakening to all beings at the same time that we do it for ourselves, okay, then it's taking each of the Brahma Viharas and looking for situations where it seems appropriate to bring that energy to bear. So, in terms of compassion, where there is cruelty, may I bring compassion, may I bring caring. Where there is sadness, may I bring joy. Where there is violence, may I bring peace. And where there is hatred, may I bring love. As you can see from the words and from the way the Buddha taught the Brahma Viharas, it's not a vow to change things. It's a vow to bring your own qualities of heart-mind to bear in situations that are characterized by these different forms of suffering. So you're not trying to overcome or overpower. Rather, what you're seeking to do is like this focus energy of your intentions you bring to bear on whatever the situation is. Okay. So in terms of practical application, it's discerning first, you know, what forms and causes of cruelty or sadness or violence or hate are out there. We know that in one way or another, they're all manifestations of the kalesas. And then determining what forms of skillful action might be appropriate to make a healing contribution to the situation. That's very contextual, it's very situation specific, but it is a means by which this beneficial intention can manifest in practical ways that puts to work, you know, our Brahma Vihara practice in the world. As I've been seeking to do this through various forms of public service and advocacy just lately, I've come to realize that the quality of the work, the ability to do the work, seems to have an awful lot to do with what's going on for us inside. So, for instance, you know, if we're talking about where there is cruelty, may I bring caring. Where there is sadness, may I bring joy. Where there is violence, may I bring peace. Where there is hatred, may I bring love. If, in fact, at any given time, we're feeling a little cruel, we want really bad things to happen to leaders or people we don't like, you know, if we're really feeling bummed out and down, you know, instead of joyful or happy, you know, if we, you know, really just as soon do something very intemperate and destructive to somebody rather than something nice, if we're really feeling, you know, extreme aversion rather than love, okay, then it's probably not a really good time to go out and act. What has to happen first is a kind of an inner healing, you know. When we're talking about where there is cruelty, you can think of that as a situation out in the world. But you can also think about it in terms of what's going on in your own heart. You know, what's really in there? If I am feeling cruelty, may I bring compassion or caring to that feeling within me? Is there a way that I can manifest some joy to be with my sadness? Okay. Is there a way I can examine violent thoughts or intentions that arise in me, see what's behind them, and bring equanimity to bear? Is there a way that I can, I'm feeling powerful aversion or hatred even, is there a way that I can bring love to bear on it first in my own heart? Because that's the necessary work that precedes being able to do it in the world. A few years ago, my wife and I were living in Barcelona in Spain. I was on sabbatical, and I'd managed to get this appointment as a visiting scholar and lecturer in the School of Law at the University of Barcelona. And just loved living in the city. It was just a terrific experience. But it was a little dodgy in terms of pickpockets. There have been efforts made on our property in different places around Europe, but Barcelona was the place where, and by and large, I felt, you know, we both felt pretty safe there. It wasn't like there was, you know, any heavy duty likelihood of really being badly harmed. But there was a lot of pickpocketing going on, and we were living in this neighborhood a few blocks off La Rambla, which is a kind of a main pedestrian mall down the middle of the city by the beach. And we were both walking to the train. I was getting ready to catch the train out to campus. I had my valise over my shoulder. And as we were walking along, this young man approached us. And one of the ways that I've since learned that pickpockets work, Americans in particular, is that in many European countries, there is not the tradition of shaking hands, you know, or touching bodies or something. But if a pickpocket wants to get in close and he spots an American, what he'll do is come in, you know, stick out his hand, you know, wants to shake hands and get in their space. And we reflexively, that's just kind of what we do. And so he comes along and he was saying, hey, you got a light, how's it going and whatnot? And he sticks out his hand and says, hey, I'm so and so. I reached out and got, and then what he did, he tried to pull me into him, so, and then trip me so he could grab my valise and run away. I'd been taking Tai Chi, for about 40 years by then. You know, it's been my martial art all my life, including a school for a while where we did the 45-minute long form, you know, super slow and whatnot. And then we did the same form in 2 minutes. It was kind of demonstrating the relationship between Tai Chi and Kung Fu. But I, you know, I'd never used it. I'd only ever, you know, done all this stuff in class. But what happens with that really slow motion moving is that it teaches the muscles at a very cellular level. You know, you're just really incorporate all those moves in a way that's totally unconscious. And so what happened when he, you know, tried to pull me into him and knock me down is that I stepped back and planted a foot and then put my fingertips, my hands on his chest. And there's this kind of thing that you do where all of a sudden your energy gets focused and knocked him back about 3 or 4 feet. And he just turned and ran away. Completely unconscious. He had no idea where it came from except from that 40 years of training, looking back on it, you know, what made it possible in terms of that movement at that moment was stepping back and planting a foot, you know, getting grounded and lowering down a little bit. And I've come to learn that that same approach really, really seems important in doing engaged Buddhist work, in bringing Buddha Dharma to the street. Not in terms of hand-to-hand combat, but what I mean by, and, you know, and using this analogy right now, is that you need to be grounded. You need to have that foot place. You know, you need to have the grounding that makes it possible to move forward in an effective way. Because if you're not grounded, if your mind really is absorbed in cruelty or, you know, violence or hate or whatever, then you are unstable. You are unstable. And you can get knocked over by the power of your own emotions and wind up doing some pretty unskillful stuff. So that sense of being grounded, you know, of knowing where you're coming from, what you're intending to do and why, of having some confidence in your own intentions really seems to be pretty central to the whole thing. So that's what I got. Let's talk. If anything that I said resonates with anything in your own experience, or you have any questions about this, or just want to share your own experience, please do so. Just unmute yourself and we'll go for it. Karen?
So, this is Karen. I liked what, back when you started, you know, you said, you mentioned that kind of thinking that brought together different sort of oppositional attitudes about different schools of Buddhism. And you said, you know, there's one Dharma, not many distinctions appear from clinging. Yeah, great. And what caught me today was, if the trouble with clinging is that we become unable to take in that fullness and richness that the Dharma has to offer. And like all of us, I've been thinking a lot about racism lately.
Yes.
And that is so true of humanity as well. To the extent that we are clinging to identities where we are part of separate groups, we are losing out on the full richness that humanity has to offer us.
Quite so.
I thought.
Oh yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. It's like the illusion of separateness is an awful lot of what we're up against right now, isn't it? You know, it's like taking a hammer in one hand and hitting your other hand with it. You know, it's without realizing that the two are actually connected. They belong to the same body. So I think you're right. I think a good deal of what needs to continue to be happening is drawing attention to and focusing on that interconnectedness. And that has a, you know, of course it has a lot to do with awakening to any ways that any of us unconsciously use our power or authority to maintain a particular status at the expense of somebody else. Sure, thank you.
Thanks.
So, anybody else want to share? Well, in that case, let's go out singing. The classic Sanskrit phrase for the invocation of Tara is Om Tare Tu Re Svaha. And I've heard many different renderings of it. It basically, it's three parts or three sets of intentions. Om Tare is come quickly, Tara, you know, this is Bodhisattva of compassionate action. To, you know, help me in my time, help me and protect me in my time of struggle. Om Tare, Tu Tare. And then the third phrase, Tu Re Svaha. Come quickly, you know, out of the universe to aid me, okay? Help me in my time of travail, okay? And then transform me. So it's like you and Tara become one. And then Tu Re Svaha, the word Tara in Sanskrit, in English it means star. It's like a shining, you know, radiating celestial being. So come Tara, be my refuge, okay. And then may we light the world. Okay. So that's the three part intention in Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Svaha. So I put all these words over in the chat column if you want to have a look at them later on. And there have been several renditions of the Om Tare Champa music, and the one that I'm going to do is from Deva Pamal and her album Into the Light. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Svaha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Svaha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Svaha. Come Tara, be my refuge from harms within, around about. Come Tara, shine within me, light our world with tender love. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Svaha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Svaha. We'll take it, friends. Let's take our sitting posture again for just a moment, if we can. Allowing the eyes to gently close, attention to come to rest on the breathing. Where there is cruelty, may we bring caring. Where there is sadness, may we bring joy. Where there is violence, may we bring peace. And where there is hatred, may we bring love. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. And may all beings be free. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free. Thanks for coming around this evening. Stay safe and be well. Have a good week.